failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Hello, my friends, and welcome to this second edition of Century of Lies. Running kind of ragged this week. I'll be in Washington, D.C. this weekend for the mass protest against mass incarceration. You can learn more about it by visiting their website, which is journeyforjustice.org. Today, our guest is Siobhan Reynolds, the president of the Pain Relief Network. We'll also have a report from Judge James P. Gray, the author of Why the Drug War Has Failed and What We Can Do About It, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs. We'll also hear from Jean Marlowe from the Women's Organization for National Prohibition Reform, Phil Smith with the Corrupt Cop Story of the Week, Loretta Nall with the U.S. Marijuana Party with an update about Mark Emery's arrest in Canada for selling seeds to Americans. We'll also hear from Mr. Ed Rosenthal with some amazing news about marijuana. And I'm sure to throw in a few things to tweak your brain, get you going. But let's start with our interview with Siobhan Reynolds.
As part of our ongoing effort to expose the many facets of this drug war, once again today we're going to talk about pain management in today's America. And I'm proud to have with us today as our guest, Siobhan Reynolds. She's the president of the Pain Relief Network. If you will, tell us about your organization.
Well, we are New York City based, although we say generally we're web based because we're all over the country. I happen to live and have my offices in New York, but we work all over the United States. We are a network of pain patients and physicians and lawyers, policy people, all working toward a day when patients in pain are treated with the same level of dignity and autonomy and respect and decency that we expect of the treatment of other people in with severe illness.
Now, on a daily basis, we see the stories of how the DEA or local law enforcement officials go after people for taking pain medications, and they go after the doctors and the pharmacists now for prescribing those drugs. Talk about just the general situation.
Well, the situation's bad. I mean, what happened was in the late 90s, medicine moved forward not realizing that there was a federal push against the adequate treatment of pain in the United States. So the doctors went ahead and started saying, oh, you know, everybody should get their pain treated, and the medical boards are the people that actually run the regulation of medicine. That's what the Constitution says, so we can go ahead and do that, and we'll just change the way things are going. We'll make it less punitive, and we'll make sure that doctors document what they're doing and all that, but we will insist that doctors who call themselves physicians treat pain, that that's a normal part of medical practice. Well, what happened was really just about after 9/11, the federal government started cracking down on physicians that actually did that, that took the government up, and the FDA had called for pain treatment, and many people, Health and Human Services. And so the doctors were doing it. And when they were doing it, they became victims of the Drug Enforcement Administration. What happened was they would send in decoys, fake patients. They would go through people's pharmacy records and find any vulnerable people in there, any like ex-con or something like that, put them up against a bunch of years and, you know, of time, and suggest that if they would just simply turn and testify against their physician, then they would find themselves without any more legal problems. And so this sort of snitch-driven prosecution, which is everyone's familiar with in terms of the regular drug war, was transferred over to medical practice. And we have seen an absolute public health catastrophe that has resulted from this. It's a travesty, but it's an inevitability when, as a society, we've put the idea that we should be drug-free ahead of any notions of decency or civility. And so that's what we get.
Now, I know as part of your work you are involved with, and you track the situations where the DEA busts these pain doctors for working with legitimate patients. Tell us about some of those.
Well, I have. I've worked with many of the prosecutions across the United States, and all of the very high-profile ones, including Dr. Hurwitz, the case at Comprehensive Care in South Carolina, which was actually the DEA's flagship prosecution in their campaign. Also Dr. Rotschafer in Pennsylvania, Dr. Hassman in Arizona. We've got doctors all over the United States who've had this happen to them. I've watched a pattern. I've watched doctors who were treating pain in good faith suddenly set upon by so many different branches of the federal government. It's mind-boggling. If you go and take a look at the press release that was released after Dr. Hurwitz's sentencing, the DEA proudly announces, I think, something like 7 different federal agencies were involved in that prosecution, including the Office of Inspector General of the Pentagon. So to say that they're piling on is an understatement. They charge these doctors with hundreds and hundreds of crimes. They take each prescription and each doctor-patient exchange as an opportunity to charge the doctor with 3 or 4 different kinds of crimes, like money laundering or tax evasion or controlled substances violations or Medicare and Medicaid fraud, you name it. And basically what they've done is made it so that nobody in their right mind would write a prescription for a controlled substance at this point.
And what is that going to mean for the baby boomers as they age? What does that mean to each of us who might be in pain?
Well, it means aging. It's funny people bring it up. I'm more worried about getting hit by a car today. If you get hit by a car today and you get taken to the hospital and you're lucky enough to live and they manage to fix you up but not to where you are completely out of pain, you might think that what the medical profession would do would be to at least palliate your situation, right? They would at least do the best they could so that you could go back to work, take care of your family, that sort of thing. But what you would find once you were in this terribly vulnerable spot, having not worked for several months, you'd find that you weren't going to be allowed to go back to work, that you weren't going to be allowed to recover, that you were going to slowly and systematically die, that you were going to quit being able to sleep because you're in so much pain. You would start gaining weight. Your organs would start depleting all of the adrenaline that they provide that keeps you alive when you're in a dire situation. And you basically would die of panic, which is what people are doing all over the United States right now. And they go to doctors and they ask them for help and can't they please treat their pain? And the doctors simply can't listen to them. And the doctors don't listen to them. And you hear all kinds of doctors saying, well, I don't want to treat you because I'm afraid you'd become addicted. That's kind of code for the doctors are afraid that they might go to jail.
I'm looking at your website here, and it's showing that over 50 million people are living in untreated, disabling pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a direct result of these doctors' fear or other inability to prescribe proper medication.
That's true. And, in fact, the American Medical Association even says it's 75 million. We have several different figures, depending on where you come from, so I sort of took the one right in the middle. And I thought it was safe to say 50 million. But the AMA itself says 75 million. You know, it isn't a problem that just began. You know, it has been a result of drug prohibition. I mean, when you essentially make it a crime for a physician to, quote, maintain an addict on opioid pain medications, what you've done without realizing it is you've outlawed chronic pain treatment. Because how is the doctor supposed to be able to know if the person that they're giving opioids to is an addict or a pain patient? Now, of course, there are major distinguishing features of the two conditions, but people who are addicts and who want only to get the medication and, for instance, to sell it are very good at pretending to be pain patients. They're also oftentimes, and this has been my experience and what I think really nails the whole thing, is that these people are pain patients. Many of the people who divert drugs are people in pain. So all they have to do is go in, ask for more medications than they really need, take what they need to get by, sell the rest, and use the money that they get in order to pay for the money for the drugs they need to actually live on. We've also found that some enormous number of people right now are, when they talk about diverted drugs, the 75% or more of the drugs that are being diverted are going to pain patients who can't get them through physicians. So, it's a ridiculous, enormous problem, and these prosecutions are doing no good. All they're doing is bad. All they're doing is harm. They are in no way limiting anybody's access to medications. The only people they're limiting access to are people who need the medications, the people who are legally entitled to take them. And it's an absolute disgrace. And the worst part of it is the Congress will not listen to us on this subject. They just won't. They won't hear about it.
Siobhan, what I guess I'm hearing is that this could impact any one of us today. It could impact one of our family members, and we need to make allowances for that treatment of pain. So what can we do? What can we do to help make a difference? How can we make a more compassionate future available to ourselves?
Well, you can begin by joining the Pain Relief Network, painreliefnetwork.org, and you can make a contribution, give until it hurts. The people that we advocate for are the most marginalized and ruined people on the face of the planet. They can't even march on Washington. They can't march on Selma, Alabama. They can't do any of the things that other oppressed minorities have done because they can't get out of bed and they can't even make enough money to feed themselves and take care of their families. So it's important that people with resources contribute to this cause so that we can all come together on behalf of these most marginalized people. The other reason it's important to join up with PRN and contribute is because we are the only organization that is taking this issue on in D.C. and in a media strategy, making the public aware of the problem, and we are not funded in any way by pharmaceutical companies, nor do we represent the interests of academic medicine. Every other foundation that purports to represent the interests of pain patients, when you look at their boards and where the funding comes from, what you actually see is that they are funded by organizations that have other agendas, and that's reflected in the lack of movement on this issue. That was the fact that it was stagnant, really, for so many years until PRN came along to shake things up. We're bipartisan. We're not interested in any political party. We're not interested in any particular political game. What we want is to begin here, is to say that America can do better than this. It can do better than marginalizing and abusing the most vulnerable citizens we have. And we can. We can make sure that if you work all your life and you have, in essence, given your body to this country in form of labor, and if it ends up destroyed as a result, that we as a society will at least see to it that as you go into retirement, that you won't be in abject agony for no reason.
Well, we've been speaking with Siobhan Reynolds, the president of the Pain Relief Network. We thank you for being with us. Any closing thoughts?
No, I just think that we all need to also look at people in pain differently. We need to see it as a disease and not just as something that people should have to abide. These drugs are good. They're chemically identical to the drugs we have in our bodies already that we treat pain with naturally. And we have to overcome the stigma that we all carry with us and that we then put on sick people. So we need to check ourselves for our own prejudices.
It's time to play Name That Jurisdiction by Its Drug Law. This nation imposes the death penalty on adults trafficking in as little as 1/2 ounce of heroin, 1 ounce of morphine, or 18 ounces of marijuana. It has executed hundreds of people for drug-related offenses. If you like to get high, you're welcome to die in Singapore.
My name is Judge Jim Gray. I am a judge of the Superior Court in Orange County, California. And I have all kinds of irons in the fire now that I have ended my campaign as a libertarian for the U.S. Senate, and I'm doing some real constructive things. I've written a musical that we're actually taping for a PBS television station here, and that's kind of fun. I'm actually working on a movie in creation with regard to both medical marijuana as well as the drug war in general, with a man that has gotten a couple of Academy Awards, and he's filming already, and we're going to blow the top off this drug war before we're done. My book is selling pretty well, and I'm still going around the country talking about the failing drug war. No, it's worse than that. The failed drug war? No, it's hopeless, and that's the way I talk about it, and I'll certainly not be deterred from continuing that, because we couldn't do that whole thing worse than we tried. What I do is ask people who is winning with regard to the war on drugs today, and that's pretty straightforward. The people that are winning are the big drug dealers, the people in government that are getting great hordes of tax money to fight against the first group, the politicians that keep winning by talking tough, not smart, with regard to the war on drugs. People, the fourth group, are in the private sector that make money because of increased crime, That means people that build prisons or staff prisons or sell security alarm systems or that sort of thing. And the fifth group of people that are winning are the terrorists, because they are the ones who are getting primary funding from drug prohibition. You know, you're always going to have radical people out in this world, but if they're not funded, they're far less dangerous. And they are winning because the drug war is literally funding them. And who's losing? Of course, everybody else, particularly our children, who are recruited to sell drugs because of the money. You know, they're not recruited to sell alcohol, because alcohol is controlled and regulated by the government. It's the illegal drugs, the illegality of the drugs, that convert and corrupt our children. So, Dean, I'm pretty busy. It's a lot going on. Life is good. I have no complaints in the world, except I would very much like to change away from drug prohibition. Understanding, and I see this in my court all the time, that drug prohibition fosters crime, violent crime. Homicides went down 60% in the year after we finally came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibition. We'll realize the same phenomenon when we finally repeal drug prohibition. So it's a pleasure to talk with you anytime. Look forward to maybe even spending a little more time together. You're doing very good work. I'm proud of you and proud to be on your show.
Judge Gray is scheduled to join us for the bulk of the show on September 9th, right here on Century of Lies.
So what's that you're holding?
The Controlled Substances Act.
Controlled Substances Act? Brilliant! What you do with it?
Well, I found a way to incarcerate 1.6 million Americans every year.
Can you arrest them in their own homes, wherever they are?
Yes!
Arrest people wherever they are? Brilliant! What else are you working on?
Claiming that marijuana is more dangerous than crack.
More dangerous than crack? Brilliant!
Brilliant!
Prohibition, the drug trafficker's dream. Enjoy it everywhere.
Brilliant!
Please visit the Drug Truth Network. DrugTruth.net.
This is Phil Smith of the Drug War Chronicle with this week's Corrupt Cops story for the Drug Truth Network. This week we're going to Springfield, Missouri, down in the beautiful Ozarks, where former Missouri State Highway Patrol Crime Lab technician Matthew Barb, age 31, pleaded guilty August 5th to stealing confiscated drugs, the AP reported. As a person responsible for testing about one-third of suspected drugs seized in southwest Missouri, Barb's thefts forced prosecutors in two counties to dismiss some 380 drug cases. While he faces up to 7 years in prison, under a plea agreement with prosecutors, they recommended a 5-year sentence. He was apparently stealing the dope for his own use, and his defense attorney, D. Wampler, told the AP he had already undergone drug treatment and counseling and had submitted monthly urine tests. Wampler will ask for probation for her client, she said. As always, there are more Corrupt Cop stories this week. Check them out at StopTheDrugWar.org.
In 2 weeks' time, we'll be reporting on the first ever International Methamphetamine, HIV, and Hepatitis Conference. This one is to be held in Salt Lake City, and I just learned that Mr. Phil Smith will also be attending, along with yours truly. We should have some fine reports from that conference. Drug prohibition. 90 years of success. Lead us to this day. Our children pick up the phone and drugs are delivered within the hour. Because that's how we like it. Overdose deaths, preventable by a phone call, are assured by paranoia. Yes, we are number one. Violent drug gangs are the scourge of our continent. We insist that their jobs pay so very well. Terrorists turn flowers into million-dollar bankrolls to buy bigger weapons to kill us. So each year, we give them $500 billion. To make it so, we are the champions of the world.
Hello, everybody out there in drug policy reform land. Well, it has been a wild couple of weeks for all of us. As everybody knows, the DEA went into Canada and had the RCMP arrest Mark Emery on an extradition warrant for shipping seeds to the United States. They're trying to extradite him, Michelle Rainey Fincarrick, and Greg Williams to the U.S. to stand trial. The Seattle DEA office, field office, had gone out of their way to make this seem non-political. This arrest of Mark Emery was non-political. It had nothing to do with his politics, they said. And then their hitch woman boss lady in Washington, D.C., Karen Tandy, faxed a press release to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer that I just got a copy of this morning. Tandy said, "Today's DEA arrest of Mark Emery publisher of Cannabis Culture Magazine and the founder of Marijuana Legalization Group, is a significant blow not only to the marijuana trafficking trade in the U.S. and Canada, but also to the marijuana legalization movement. His marijuana trade and propagandist Marijuana Magazine have generated nearly $5 million a year in profits that bolstered his trafficking efforts, but those have gone up in smoke today. Boy, isn't she cute. Emory and his organization have been designated as one of the Attorney General's most wanted international drug trafficking organizational targets, one of only 46 in the world and the only one in Canada. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of Emory's illicit profits have been channeled to the marijuana legalization groups active in the U.S. and Canada. Drug legalization lobbyists now have one less pot of money to rely on. What that means is she's admitted that it was more political than worrying about, you know, getting pot or pot seeds out of the U.S. The U.S. Marijuana Party issued a press release calling for her resignation, and we got some other tricks up our sleeve that I don't want to elaborate on just yet. But Miss Tandy is going to be made to answer to her statement, and I believe that her big mouth has royally screwed up the extradition case as it refers to Mark and his associates, and about that I am extremely happy. I'd like to remind everybody out there, we have a march, prison reform march in Washington, D.C. this weekend at Lafayette Park. If you're in or around that area or can get there, please come out and join us. We don't need to be importing prisoners from Canada because we have way too many prisoners in the U.S. already. How about we let some of ours go? This is Loretta Nall reporting for the U.S. Marijuana Party from Alabama. Until next time, y'all be safe and stay out of jail.
Stand, or forever kneel.
This is Jean Marlowe. I'm the executive director of the Women's Organization for National Prohibition Reform.
It seems that every other story in the newspapers and is about the drug war. Let's talk about how it impacts our society.
Well, Dean, there are approximately 2 million children. A little over 2 million children that have a parent or a guardian in prison. That's approximately 40,000 children per state. The majority of these children are on some form of state-funded social service, whether it be free lunch program, food stamps, foster care, Medicaid, and it's breaking the budget of the state's Medicaid program. It's costing money every way they turn. They're locking up. These laws are locking up the tax base for these citizens in drug charges, which should be treated as a health issue, not as a criminal issue.
Tell the folks more about your organization.
Well, WOMPR was originally founded in 1929 to help end the destruction from alcohol prohibition. And we resurrected it in 2003 following the Goose Creek incident, where cops went into Goose Creek High School and held children at gunpoint with no safeties on the guns at all. These children, this was is part of a drug raid which produced no weapons, no narcotics, no marijuana, no nothing. You know, and these children were held at gunpoint and handcuffed, and they were innocent of anything. And that just pushed it beyond our tolerance level. When they started holding kids at gunpoint and started taking the drug war into the schools, it was time for us to say, well, no, you're not going to be holding our kids at gunpoint.
With all these stories I spoke of about the drug war, the home invasions, the street corner shootings, the arrests of innocent people, it seems people would want to get on board. Again, give us that website.
The website is www.wonpr.org, and the video is available. It's only a 10-minute video, but it's in high quality. You can watch it. It shows, you know, the officers holding these kids at gunpoint.
Well, I appreciate you joining us for this brief moment, and I urge folks out there to join forces, to work together to end this madness.
We need to bring some type of common sense to our current policies, because what they're doing now is only causing more problems.
This summer, a conference was held in Clearwater, Florida, for the International Cannabinoid Research Society. And I got a chance to speak to the guru of ganja, Mr. Ed Rosenthal, about that conference.
Yes, well, let me explain what the ICRS is first. That's the International Cannabinoid Research Society. And this is the scientists who either work directly for the government or under government grants for the pharmaceutical companies, Dr. Donald Pashkin. He's been studying lungs under grants from the federal government for the last 20 years. He's a professor at UCLA. And for years he's been reporting that there are precancerous growths associated with smoking marijuana. But he never actually found any cancers. So he decided to, so one of his graduate students suggested that they do a population study in the Los Angeles area. And people's lungs in the Los Angeles area, you know, are challenged because of the extremely bad air in parts of Los Angeles. So they did this population study, and here's what it showed. The people who used just marijuana had a lower rate of cancer than the general population.
Wow.
In fact, they couldn't find any cancers of people who used just marijuana. People who used marijuana and tobacco had a lower rate of cancer than people who used tobacco alone.
If God had long hair and a goatee, and if his eyes were pretty glazed, if he looked spaced out, would you buy his story? Would you believe he had an eye infection? And yeah, God looks baked. Yeah, God smells good. Yeah. What if God smoked cannabis? Hit the bong like some of us. Drove a tie-dye microbus and pieced the scraps to Rolling Stone.
Reading from the Good Book, Genesis, chapter 1, verse 11 and 12. And God said, Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind. And God saw that it was good. These charlatans in the legislatures, wearing the black robes and wearing the badge, will soon enough have their day in court for participating in this abomination of drug war. Some quick program notes. Word to all the affiliates out there who may be taking the feed of Century of Lies, please let me know, dean@drugtruth.net. And if you're carrying this new show, I'll produce a new Century of Lies program for the week of August 26th. That's when the mothership will be in pledge drive. Also want to note that during that pledge drive, Winston Francis, the man who presents the official government truth, and I will produce a rather interesting pledge drive show for use by the affiliates. Let us know. With the recent discovery of hundreds of bodies of the disappeared in Colombia, with Venezuela now kicking the Drug Enforcement Administration out of their country, and with the New York Times even writing about the debunking of the drug war, it's time for you, my friends, to do something. I urge you to take the time to write that letter, to send that email, to make that call.
In closing, there is no justice, no logic, no scientific fact, no religious underpinnings, no moral clarity, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue another second. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. We've been duped. Please become part of the solution. Dare to speak the truth. Prohibito istoc ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition. The century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.